Technology.ie number 55.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the Technology.ie podcast, episode 55 for January 11th, 2013, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Hello and welcome to Technology.ie. My name's Conor Muinichon and his name is Michaela Nealon. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Con.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. You're so nice to me.
You're here every week. What'll we start with this week, Michaela? It's actually a busy week this week in Ireland in terms of tech news and all these issues and discussions about copyright and discussions in relation to regulation of social media. We've been talking about all of that over the last few weeks, and there've been further developments in both of those stories. So what'll we start with?
I don't know. I mean, it's a bit of a hard one. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, I found that since we came back after Christmas, it's just been one thing after another. I mean, in the domain world, there's a load of little changes going on, plus projects that we were working on. And, you know, there's a whole load of other stuff. I don't know. There seems to be a lot of activity.
Well, let's start with something, Michaela. We'll pick the newspaper.
Can we go with the cookies?
The cookies, sure, yeah.
This is one of these ones that I think we missed it somehow. I'm not sure how.
Okay, let me see if I can find the notes on this. Okay, so first of all, can I just say I've noticed an increase in sites informing me that they're using cookies. I didn't actually know why that was, but there's actually regulation and legislation involved here. Is that right?
I can't. I know.
Fill me in. Why? What's the story?
Well, okay. What happened is that the European Union passed directives mandating that websites inform users of their usage of cookies. This is going back well over a year ago, but obviously each member state had to implement it, and there was a transition period, etc., etc., etc. So that was. Fine, that was grand. The UK moved forward. They had their implementation. Ireland had its one as well. But the UK was getting a lot more attention in the media, whereas Ireland, for some reason, I don't know, it just didn't seem to get quite the same level of attention. But back there before Christmas, the Irish Computer Society held a thing in Dublin, which was to do with cookies and other, it was mainly to do with cookies, and I gave a presentation on that. Mm. And we can add a link to my presentation in the show notes. Woohoo! But what happened, what we're just talking about now, is just before Christmas, the Data Protection Commissioner decided to take action, because reports had shown that a very, very high percentage of Irish websites had done absolutely nothing to implement the legislation. Mm. I mean, they'd made absolutely no changes to any aspect of their websites. Everything was as it had always been, with absolutely no change, no information given to users about which site, about what they were doing. So the DPC went out, wrote a letter, sent it out to a lot of companies and websites and things like that. And the list is published on their website. And it's an interesting list. Have you had a chance to look at that list, Con?
It's a very interesting list, Michaela, because not only does it include some of the best known and, you would imagine, tech-savvy Irish websites, but it includes an awful lot of government and even media websites as well.
Oh, yeah. So there's ones here that just jump off the page. You're just going, oh, my God.
Well, first of all, fair enough. It's okay. Top of the list there, 2FM, followed by.
Well, it's in alphabetical order.
It is. So 2FM is there. Fair enough. It is alphabetical order. So national radio station, AA Ireland is in there. Adverts.ie is in there, which of course is that still part of Boards.ie?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah,
and that's on the list as well. Boards.ie as well. State bodies such as Bord Gáis and Bus Éireann, eFlow, Aircom, Electric Ireland, just jump around it. They're all in there. Businesses such as Groupon.ie. Is that Groupon or is that the Irish Times? I'm not sure who owns that now, is it?
No, Groupon.ie is Groupon.
Is Groupon, as you'd expect.
Yeah. There's Grab One, Groupon, GoHop. There's a bunch of county councils. There's anything and everything. There's betting sites, there's entertainment sites, the supermarkets. Ryanair is on the list, and there's a bunch of banks. I mean, AIB's on, I think, no, Allied Irish Banks is on, the Bank of Ireland, and a few others. Now, interestingly enough, you'll find that most of these sites are now compliant. I haven't checked every single one, obviously, right. But just kind of a spot check on a bunch of them. Like, all the Boards ones are now compliant. If you go to boards.ie or adverts.ie, you get the notification at the top of the page saying, hey, we use cookies. This, you want to find out more, click here, etc., etc., etc. I don't know about the government ones. I don't know if they've changed things. Let's just try one.
So when was this list published?
The 19th of December, just before Christmas.
Okay. And so essentially, now the letter they were written to. So these people got sent a letter, and let's just check out the letter. I haven't seen the letter yet. Dear Data Compliance Manager, on July the 1st, 2011, statutory instrument number blah blah came into law in Ireland, introduced a number of amendments to previous regulations, etc., regarding cookies and all of that. Okay. The purpose of this letter is to gather information to assist the Data Protection Commissioner in understanding how organisations are working towards or have achieved compliance with the revised rules. So if your company has not yet achieved compliance, please provide an explanation. So what you're saying, Michaela, is that in short order, most of these websites have hopped to it since they got a letter from the commissioner.
Well, some of them have. I decided to do a quick spot check whilst talking to you. Mm. The Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine doesn't seem to have made any changes. So let's pick on government departments.
Now, is it
Department of Arts, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, or Gaeltacht, or however you pronounce that?
Gaeltacht.
Let me see. Nope.
No.
They haven't done anything. Let's try the Department of Health.
Interesting.
Let's see. Nope. So just from doing a quick spot check, it looks like the government ones haven't done anything.
Well, I guess some of them have implemented it, and some of them have. The terms of the letter, they've been given 21 days to outline their approach or explain what they're doing. So I guess a few more of them have at the very least written back to the commissioner and said, you know, give us another couple of weeks or whatever it might be. Is this difficult to do, Michaela, to have this kind of notice pop up and say to you, we're using cookies, is this okay with you?
Well, to be perfectly honest, in short, no, it's not really. I mean, there's a number of different ways you can address it. I mean, it depends on how far you want to take it. Because this is one of the things that I think is evolving a bit in terms of there's, you know, the idea of the difference between explicit consent and implied consent.
Okay.
So if you look at taking some of the international bigger websites, like say the BBC, or actually BT is another one, which is a good example. If you go onto a lot of those sites, some of them will give you a huge amount of control and a huge amount of information about the cookies. And they'll say, right, you know, we're using all these different types of cookies. These are the ones that are fairly innocuous. These are the ones that are slightly more intrusive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you even have control over which ones to set, which ones not to set. Whereas with other sites, what they've done is they've gone, right, look, we're using cookies. These are the ones we're using. If you know, we've made you aware of this, please continue to use our website.
Okay. Consider yourself informed, as it were.
Consider yourself informed. The thing is, though, that because this is EU-wide, You'll find that a lot of the content management systems, Joomla, WordPress, Magento, all of these things, people have already developed plugins and extensions and, you know, code snippets and whatever to do this for you.
So depending on your content management system, there's probably an off-the-shelf solution right there for you to use.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, like I went, like just yesterday, I think it was yesterday evening, I was having a look at the number of plugins available for, WordPress it was impressive. I mean, if you do a search on their plugin database, if you search for cookie law, there are 35 plugins. So, and they vary in complexity. I mean, some of them are incredibly simple. Some of them are much more complicated. And some of them, you know, it's a very simple little bar. Other ones are using a JavaScript pop-up. There's a whole load of different ways of doing it. It's the same if you look at my slides. I took screen grabs from a bunch of other CMSs like Joomla, and I can't remember which one I looked at, and you can see, you know, there's a variety of different ways you can do this.
Right. Have you given me a link to those slides? You have? Will we post them with?
Because that would be far too easy, Colin.
Yeah. No, you haven't.
No, of course not. No, I'll do that. Sorry.
Oh yeah, no problem. But will we post that with the podcast as well on the blog?
Oh, do.
Okay,
do.
Very good. So if you send me on a link for that, and we'll do that. It's in you've posted this on the Black Knight blog already, is what you're saying. I see.
Because I gave a presentation on this back in early December.
Okay.
Now, see, it's just interesting to see, though, Khan, because, you know, I would say that what they've done here is they've done this to send a nice, big, visible warning to businesses. You know, you need to sort this out. So here's a bunch of high profile websites that we found not to be compliant. We're giving them a nice warning. The rest of you might want to pay heed to this.
Michele, how extensive is cookie use nowadays? I mean, and has it evolved in recent years from, I suppose, the early days of cookies and, you know, recognizing that somebody had been there before? What kind of information is tracked? What value, what use is it to a website to use cookies?
I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things that there's different types of cookies and they're used for different things.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, I'm trying to think of something. Let's say, you know, logging you into a website.
That's the most common
use cookies.
That's the most common use that people would be familiar with.
Then you've got a bunch of tracking cookies. Then you've got a whole range of other things like that, you know, could do with, you know, your functionality. But what is, you know, upsets the privacy people is when you've got cookies that, you know, they don't have any real functionality in terms of, you know, the end user experience. What they're all they're really doing is helping the publisher garner more information about, you know, your browsing habits and everything else.
I have to say it's become something I've become immune to over the years. I never worry about cookies. I never think about them. And I've seen these information notices pop up now on websites that I've been visiting over the last several months. And I've almost completely ignored them or gone, yeah, right, get me to the whatever it was I came to this webpage for in the first place. Just don't care as much.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Con, look, I mean, ultimately, you know, you're going to find that some websites are going to tell you exactly what they're doing, and you're not going to be bothered about it. Other ones, you might want to sit back a little bit and go, hold on a second, maybe I need to be a little bit more careful about this.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a look at the slides, if you have a look, there's a couple of references in there to, you know, other studies and articles and things like that. It's quite interesting because what the real challenge is, and it's something there's a couple of other articles I've linked to for this week's show about, you know, the privacy, you know, this kind of privacy concerns going up against internet industry. And in some cases, the two can work together very, very nicely. In other cases, it's causing a certain degree of friction. Because if you look at the case, for example, at the moment, Facebook versus Germany. I don't know, have you heard about that one, Con?
Not in so much detail.
Well, it's very simple. Facebook has a real name policy. If you want to use Facebook, you're meant to use your real name.
Yes.
I think Google Plus had a similar one, which caused, you know, headaches for certain people not so long ago. Now, in most jurisdictions, it's one of these conversations. Oh, I don't like this. Oh, that service is terrible. In Germany, however, the German data privacy laws and the Data Privacy Commissioner is actually giving protection to users and saying, no, if a user wants to refer to themselves as FUBAR, well, they can. And they're entitled to do that.
Right.
So it's interesting because, you know, Facebook, instead of saying, well, okay, you know, we operate in Germany, so therefore we have to comply with German law, is actually fighting it at the moment.
Okay, let's talk about something a bit closer to home, Michele, and the big story, as you mentioned there. Simon McGarr has been blogging this over the Christmas, and I think we've touched on it every week for about the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it's been interesting because the story is about newspapers trying to charge for links. Now, Simon first blogged this back, I think, in May, Michele. We talked about it, we discussed it, we said this is hilarious, this is a joke, but the joke was followed up with another demand to Simon's client, Women's Aid, for them to pay to buy a license in order to link to articles on Irish newspapers. And it wasn't just them, as we discussed last week, Michele. You've received letters like this as well, and other people have as well. And this was a policy. Now, you've got to say, Michele, that the chorus of ridicule and mockery from around the international technological media, if you like, was pretty much universal, wasn't it, on this?
Totally. I mean,
I was getting
messages. I mean, I posted links to some of these articles onto Facebook and elsewhere, and I was getting some of the comments from friends across the four, you know, from the four corners of the globe, were, oh, come on, sure, this is an April Fool's. You know, it was kind of, this can't be true. We're going, no, this is true. This is actually happening.
And as perhaps as embarrassed as you might have been from, you know, with a little bit of national pride or whatever here, Michele, no faces were redder than those of the people, if you like, inside the national print media who have a clue. And I'm talking about people who work on the Irish Times Online and online editions of other media and things like that. People like Hugh Linehan, the online editor of the Irish Times, Johnny Ryan, who has some role with them at the moment. He's innovation manager or something with the Irish Times. People who are active on Twitter, who get it, who are part of the community, who found themselves in an impossible situation, really, didn't they?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you're an employee of a member company. Well, I don't know if they're members, but of a company that's part of the Newspapers Ireland, whatever the hell it is.
How do you tell your bosses they've lost the plot?
This is it. I mean, how do you do that? It's not an easy one to do. And, you know, there were several articles over the last couple of weeks where you had some of them trying to kind of rationalize what was being said and, you know, say, no, that's not what we meant by this. So earlier this week, Newspaper Licensing Ireland, actually it happened over the weekend, which is kind of amusing in some respects, they issued a clarification.
The message got through, it seems.
Well, yes and no. I mean, this is something I'm not 100% sure about. I mean, just, you know, for the record, the statement says, for personal use, NLI never requires or requests a license for personal use of newspaper content. Grant. But this then the second bit, for commercial use, NLine does not require a license from any organization which only displays or transmits links to newspaper content. A license is required when there is other reproduction of the newspaper content, such as display of PDFs or text extracts. Now, there's a couple of problems with that, Con. There's no definition or guideline as to what constitutes personal, what constitutes commercial.
It doesn't even matter, though, in as far as it comes to... Well, that's okay, fair enough from that point of view. But let's focus for a minute on the thing of links. They've accepted and conceded that neither in a commercial or a personal use do you need to have a license in order to link to another website. They've conceded that much, have they?
Not entirely, no.
No?
Because it says here, a license is required when there is other reproduction of the newspaper content, such as display of PDFs or text extracts.
But that's not the same as linking.
Well, okay, how do you create a link without using text, Con?
Without using what?
Text.
Oh, well, that's different. No. We're not talking about...
Well, no, you see, this is the thing. It's that, you know, it's not very clear where the line is between this is a link, this is a text extract, which is also a link.
Text extract isn't a link. No, by a text extract, they mean if you quote our website.
So if I were to quote three words from somebody, then they would consider that to require a license.
In practice, I don't think so, Michele.
Yeah, but that's the problem, Con.
Well, I don't see this as being a problem, Michele. I see this as being hugely... No, hold on a second. I see this as being hugely significant that they've moved on from the point from the notion that a hyperlink... to the website, which feeds them traffic, is something that you should have to pay for. I think that's a huge...
On that we'll agree, but on the other point, it's not clear enough.
Well, I think that fair use or fair dealings or whatever
we don't have any fair use. That's the problem.
We have some concept here in this country. I can't imagine.
Not really. No.
Yeah, I can't. Well. I can't imagine that if I used three words from an article to anchor a link to that article, I mean, it wouldn't matter. All you could have to say is just look, read this article here by Connor Pope.
I understand that. Reading it the way I read that though is that it's not clear what constitutes commercial use.
Well, that's a whole new issue, though, Michele. Isn't it fair to say? I mean, that's
because ultimately, if they're backtracking, and this is the first thing out, they need to move far beyond that.
So where should they move to?
They should move to make it to clarifying exactly what constitutes personal use, exactly what constitutes commercial use, and exactly. I mean,
maybe they do that elsewhere on the site. I don't know. I mean, it's clear enough to me, Michele, I have to say. But then again,
you don't spend all day arguing about policy, whereas I do.
I guess so. I guess so. And I see where you're coming from on this as well.
The problem I see with a lot of this is that. It's the kind of thing that, unless it's very, very clear, and unless you have very clear boundaries on certain aspects of that, it's the kind of thing that, okay, you won't hear anything about this now for 6 months, 9 months, a year.
Yeah.
And next thing, you're getting these demand letters arriving on your door.
Yes, but I think, Michele, I don't think you're going to get these demand letters arriving on the door because I don't think this is a question of simply words or anything like that. I think what this boils down to is that somebody in Newspaper Licensing Ireland has been sat down and talked to and has had it explained to them that the policy, the whole thing that they were doing, this attempt to extort money from people for simply linking to their site, and in particular going after non-profits. It's been pointed out to them, Michele, that this is counterproductive, not productive, isn't going to earn them a cent, and is really bad publicity, and it's essentially commercial suicide. I think that maybe the letter of the law needs to be tightened up, but I think the actual essential message has got through here, Michele.
I mean, I think you know, we're definitely, look, I think we actually agree, Colin. It's just I'm just wary.
You're because, just cautious, yeah.
What I'm wary of is that if you leave things with a little bit too much ambiguity, somebody somewhere will find some way of abusing it, and that could get quite ugly.
Well, at the end of the day, look, it's like the point that so many people made, and I made it when I posted last week's podcast on technology.ie, Michele. I referred to an article in the Irish Times, and I refused to link to it. You know,
yeah.
I said, I'm deliberately not going to link to this because I can't afford to, you know. So, I mean, I think that point got through. Looking at the article you've posted on technology.ie, the blog post you've put up this week in relation to this, I find the related articles are fascinating, and the headlines in particular that the international online media has used. Giga Ohm's headline, Dinosaur Alert, Irish Newspapers Desperately Trying to Charge for Links. EOGN.com, Irish newspapers will now be ignored. And that's really what we're looking at. Slugger O'Toole had a nice one as well. National Newspapers of Ireland deploy the survival instincts of the dodo. I think that's what it boiled down to, is purely and simply. They were making themselves irrelevant.
It's the same thing, Colin. I mean, we said this before. It's very, very similar to, you know, the entire thing of the music industry and other ones trying desperately to kind of, you know, trying to pull in revenue from places where they can't really pull in revenue.
Yeah.
And you know, they're doing themselves more damage than anything else.
But as I said last week, Michele, and it doesn't need to be said maybe in a way, but I desperately do hope that Irish media can find a way to monetize and survive and pay their way and pay their staff for the work they're doing, because we still need that without a doubt. Let's stick with the Irish Times, Michele. I think this is interesting because the other story which sort of blossomed over Christmas was the threats and the discussion in relation to the view expressed by many, and let's face it, the elite of Irish society. We're talking about politicians and traditional media and people who don't engage online traditionally, expressing their horror at the dirty democracy that was going on all around them, and calls for the internet and social media in particular to be regulated. I've linked to three articles in particular that I think really are leading the charge in relation to the backlash on this, which somebody else mentioned last week was imminent. Hugh Lenehan again writing in the Irish Times, big online issues lost amid Twitter phobia. And he goes on to say that, you know, if you'd been reading the Irish Times in recent days, you might have the notion that we were trying to kill online media, or that we were trying to kill social media. You know, given the fact that they had given attention and given space to well-known pundits to actually bash social media and the internet. In recent months, he said, Ireland's standing army of pundits, weary perhaps of circumnavigating the same five subjects in ever-decreasing circles, have occasionally turned their attention to the currently fashionable bogeyman of online social media and the internet. The results, he said, have not been pretty. It's a good article there on the Irish Times. Another good one as well in the Times by Jennifer O'Connell, with the headline, Politicians Try Using Social Media Before You Start Legislating.
But you don't need to go any further.
No.
So that sums it up.
It does. But speaking of politicians who do use social media and who do get it, the third link I'm going to post is from thejournal.ie, and it's an opinion column by Kieran Cannon, TD. He's a Fine Gael TD, unless I'm very much mistaken. And he is he's the Minister for State for Training and Skills. And he gets it, Michele. He says that some fear social media because they misunderstand it, or fear power being transferred from the few to the many. But it needs no more, he says, or no less regulation than our existing methods, argues Junior Minister Kieran Cannon, which is comforting, I've got to say, coming from the corridors of government.
I mean, this is what you want to see. I mean, you need to see reasoned, balanced dialogue instead of this kind of inflammatory rubbish that was being spouted by some people a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you know, the reality is, it's stuck with all these things. There is legislation there. I mean, I haven't read the entire article, but it's like, there is legislation there already.
Yeah.
I love this line. As politicians, we have to be open to fair criticism.
Exactly. Exactly. That's in the journal.ie, and we'll link as well to those two articles in the Irish Times. And you've been busy.
Will we have to pay a licence fee for linking?
No, we won't, Michele. No, relax now. It's okay. It's all over. We can rest easy, sleep easy at night. You've had a busy week, Michele. You've launched a domain lookup service.
Yeah, this is something we've been kind of working on for the last couple of months. And
it's a whois, is it?
Do you know how? I think one of the domainer bloggers picked up on the fact that we'd tweaked it and made it a lot prettier there about a week ago. So we said, look, we might as well officially announce that it's there. So who owns it? So it's whoowns.it.
Okay. Brought to you by Black Knight. What does it do?
Well, at the moment, what you can do is you can search for domains, see if they're available. If they're not available, you can get back the whois details, or if you want, you can, in partnership with Afternic, you're able to bid on them.
Oh, that's nice.
So let's say, for example, if I was to put in conom, so I won't try to write your full name because my poor little keyboard will probably explode. You know, it'll come back telling me which ones of those are available, which ones aren't, and if they're not available, you'll have the option to bid on them, or you know, to hire a broker to help you acquire the domain.
Mm. Actually, they're all available.
Well, for conom, yes.
Yeah.
But if you put in conn.whatever, you'll probably find that most of those are taken, if not all of them.
Indeed.
So, you know, you can do is you can use the brokerage service. They'll go off and they'll talk to the existing registrant and see if the registrant is willing to let the domain go.
What kind of response are you getting?
Well, you know, we're getting feedback from people. There's features people would like to see. There's features that our developers want to add. There's features I'd like to see. You know, it's one of these things. We're going to add more features to the site. We're going to offer things like the you know, the name spinning kind of concept, where you'd be able to put in a concept. So let's say, for example, if you put in the word podcast, the system should be able to come back with suggestions based on that. So instead of just going, is podcast dot whatever available, it should come back saying, right, well, here are our domain names that share that idea that are available. So let's say if we did a search for podcast, it would come back saying, well, radiopodcast.co is available, or videopodcast.co is available, or businesspodcast.me is available.
Okay.
Which all are, by the way.
Which both are they?
Oh, yeah, they are. Right. They are.
Interesting. Okay, let's move on, Michele. Google is in trouble with regulators. They've been kind of cleared in the States, haven't they?
The hook in the States.
They're off the hook. And this is in relation to whether or not when you do a Google search, Google being so ubiquitous and so much the search engine of choice for people, but when you do a search for something on Google, does Google give priority to its own services in the natural, supposedly naturally occurring organic results which come up? And the FTC in the States has said, no, it's okay, Google's off the hook, but they're not off the hook in Europe on that count.
No, not quite. I think this is something, again, which I think is something that isn't going to go away. We're going to see more of this. Like the FTC, they spent, I think it was about 2 years or something, looking into this, because Google's competitors in various markets, not just in search, were very concerned that Google, because it has so much market share, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and has so many products that compete in so many different verticals, that it was giving itself an unfair advantage. FTC basically came back saying, well, no, not really. It's grand. Leave them off. There's more to it than that, but that's the, you know, view from 10,000 feet or whatever.
I mean, just to explain to people, I mean, what we're talking about here, for example, if you do a search for, let's say, for any term at all, for technology, for example, or something like that, on the front page, on the first page, you're going to get, for example, related videos, videos related to the search. And a certain amount of those are going to be YouTube. Well, it's the dominant video site in the world anyway. That's not surprising, but you'd wonder, does YouTube get undue prominence, for example, in those video results?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. But there's more to it than that, Colin. I mean, there's also things like, say, if you type in a flight number, depending on which Google version you're using, it'll actually bring back, Google will bring back the flight details for you. So you don't even get to go to the to an airline website or to one of the many sites selling airline tickets. You know, the Google Places with the reviews is taking a lot of traffic that might have gone to TripAdvisor and to other places.
Exactly. They've got their fingers in so many pies now.
Exactly. I mean, this is it. I mean, Google makes so much money in so many different ways. You know, I mean, do you remember that post that that Damien did a couple of years ago about, you know, how to get laid using Google?
That must be, what, 4 or 5 years ago now at this stage?
Maybe longer ago, yeah. Not too sure. Yeah. But, you know, even, I mean, if you were to do an up-to-date
version of it,
I mean, yeah, it's probably would cover, you know, how Google can take you from the cradle to the grave.
Yeah. So what do you think, Michele, does the European Competition Commissioner is as I say, they've yet to decide on this. What do you think is going to be the outcome of this for Google?
I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I mean, that I don't have a magic looking glass, but it's something that they're not going to be able to escape from as easily. Because, you know, the legislation in Europe is quite different. And also, as the article that you're going to link to points out, Google has a much higher percentage of search in Europe than they do in the US. So I think it's one of these things that, you know, you could always predict it. I mean, several big companies, I mean, Google isn't the only one. There's other companies in other areas where, you know, their dominance is such that while in the US, the regulators might just kind of go, ah, that's fine, that's capitalism at work. In Europe, not so much. Because, you know, mergers, acquisitions in Europe, a lot of those come under a lot of scrutiny from the Commission and elsewhere.
I'm wondering how they go about investigating this, and conversely, how does Google go about proving its innocence in a case like this? You know, what kind of measures might a regulator insist that that Google put in place? What kind of paper walls or whatever, you know, that they put in between different divisions, or, you know, how can you make sure that there isn't favoritism?
Well, in the US, it was basically decided that they didn't need to show that there wasn't favoritism. Mm. I mean, from my reading of various reports on it. Over here, I think they're going to have a slightly harder time. But then again, you know, Google, in common with a lot of big companies, invests heavily in lobbying. So, you know, it's the kind of thing where they might be able to push it to one side for a while, and, you know, maybe nothing will come of it. I mean, if you look at what happened with Microsoft and with Internet Explorer. I mean, by the time that case actually ran its full distance, the versions that were the subject of the court case in the first case were several versions behind. I mean,
and
nobody cared.
And you know, it was already declining. I mean, Internet Explorer no longer has the dominant position that it had then. And in fact, by the time, like you said, by the time it had run its course, it was that situation. And, you know, it could be similar here as well, Michele. It's hard to imagine, but it was also hard to imagine that Internet Explorer would lose its dominant position. It's hard to imagine right now that Google is going to lose the dominance that it has. And in fairness, I think it's a more serious dominance than the preferential treatment given to a particular browser on a particular operating system.
Well, I mean, the thing is this. I mean, as you know, I found the link, by the way, that to Molly's articles back from actually 2006. The reality is, I mean, that Google dominates so many different areas. It's very, very hard to imagine a web experience at the moment without Google.
Yeah. And if you consider that this is an experience which is platform independent, Michele, it's across all kinds of devices, OSs, things like that. It's much more pervasive than the Microsoft dominance ever was.
Very much so. I mean, and the other thing is this. I mean, look, just look what happened recently with the entire Apple Maps thing. Mm. You know, we were all crying out, "Oh, for God's sake, please give us back Google Maps." Yeah. You know, so while at one level you might be going, oh my God, you know, they're dominating everything. At the on the other side of it, you're going, oh, hold on a second, we actually want this.
Yeah. Sorry for being a cliche, Michele, but we love Big Brother. Let's move on. Let's look at there's another issue in relation to regulation in the United in sorry not in the United States but in the EU as well, Michele, in relation to an attempt to limit how internet companies such as Facebook use the data that they actually manage to collect on people. What's this story about?
Well, this is something I touched on when we were talking there a bit about the privacy and everything, and Facebook. You know, because at the moment, there's a lot of sharing of data going on between different companies. You know, how, let's say, for example, if I mean, taking it as a very, very simple, I mean, very, very simplistic level. If you have a website that has traffic and you're not selling something, how do you make money from it? You sell ads. How do you sell ads more effectively? Well, you tell prospective advertisers and existing advertisers who your users are. You know, you've got X number of page views per month, Y number of users. The more information you can give, the more you can charge for the ads. Mm-hmm. So the concern here is that, you know, you take that out further and, you know, there's a potential issue that some people are looking at. We're saying, well, hold on a second. Selling the data of what users are actually looking at, that's probably, that could potentially be an infringement on their right to privacy, because they don't know that you're doing this.
But Michele, the argument has always been that this data is managed in aggregate. Isn't that the case? The defense of companies such as Facebook is that they're not giving out personal identifiable information about yourself.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, just trying to get to a middle ground where both sides of things are, you know, working well enough together, they're not killing each other, I suppose. I mean, looking at this here. What was it? One, you know, the U.S. privacy advocates estimate a Facebook user can make $10 a year for the company by clicking on ads.
Now, what this story is about? It's about members of the European Parliament, and what they're pushing for here, Michele, isn't so much to restrict this, but to give the users control. And to allow them to assent.
It comes back to the cookie thing again.
Yeah.
It's about informed consent.
Yeah. So it's about basically plans announced on Wednesday by a Green, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who's a German Green MEP, announced plans to make sure that users of search engines and social networks can control how much of their data is sold to advertisers. Why would you care, Michele?
Well, personally, I don't care that much. Mm. But at the same time, you know, people do get a little bit freaked out. You know, you're doing one thing and something else happens and you're like, hold on a second, how on earth, why am I getting an advert for the product that I was just looking at in a supermarket? You know, it's you know, this kind of convergence across multiple things.
Yeah.
You know, I checked in on Foursquare into a particular shop. Next thing, when I'm looking on the internet, I'm seeing ads for that shop.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're able to do these things. They know that you were here, that you were there, that you bought this particular thing from one website. And, you know, some of the times it's probably a positive experience. Other times people might go, well, hold on a second, this is a little bit intrusive. This is like Big Brother's watching every single bloody move I'm making.
It's interesting. I mean, we could see a situation, Michele, where if you have to give your consent for your data to be tracked and for your, I suppose, your online your data in relation to your online activity to be tracked and to be used and to be sold to advertisers, ideally, I suppose, in one sense, people would say, well, I want a cut of that. You know, bribe me, give me a prize, give me something to make it worth my while. Right now, the deal is that, and the way the companies, I suppose, like Google and Facebook have kind of approached this, is they've said, we're giving you this service for free, and in return, we get to use your data. Well, maybe the price of that data is going to go up. If there's legislation like this.
This is the thing. I mean, it's one of these... You know, I'm just thinking back. I mean, just as you were saying, that reminds me back to the earlier, much earlier days of you know, browser-based internet access, where, you know, there were a lot of these schemes and systems out there which would pay you to look at adverts. You know, then it evolves. So now you've got the thing where, you know, you are the product, and, you know, the debacle there recently about Instagram, and, you know, this, you're getting a service for free in turn for which it's being your data is being monetized, it's being sold on to advertisers. I mean, I don't know. It's something. Again, we're not hearing the end of this. I mean, what will happen here, I don't know. But it's not something that's going to go away. People are going to raise concerns about this.
Let's talk about copyright, Michele. There's a couple of stories. The first of these is the Chilling Effects 2012 report, and that shows an increase in takedown requests for 2012.
No, it doesn't show an increase, Colin. It shows a dramatic increase.
Go on.
It's Wendy Seltzer... gave this talk just there before Christmas, I think it was. It's a lightning talk. It's about 5 minutes long. Well worth watching. Quite amusing. She speaks very, very quickly. The reality is actually, though, that Wendy always speaks very quickly. Over 53 million takedowns in up to that point in 2012, and that was by second week of December or something, but there were only 3 million in 2011.
What?
Yeah.
Up to 53 from 3 million?
Yes.
Wow. And is there any explanation for this, or just more aggressive behaviour on the part of copyright owners?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, if you're not familiar with Chilling Effects... Mm. If you do a search for certain terms, let me try and think of something. I don't know. Give me the name of a porn star. because, you know, porn stars are what would be an obvious one. Movies, recorded artists, whatever. If you do a search on Google for some of these, you'll see down the bottom of the page, X number of search results have been removed due to a DMCA request, find full details on Chilling Effects. Let me actually just do a quick search. Okay, typical. I would choose the one porn star who doesn't have DMCAs. It's one of these things you see. And Chilling Effects basically acts as a clearinghouse and aggregates a lot of these takedown notices under the DMCA, which, you know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US. But there's other laws in other jurisdictions that they're also aggregating data upon. And also, if you know this open data type stuff that you're seeing from Facebook, Twitter, and Google, where they're sharing the data about the takedown requests they're getting from governments. So if you look at Wendy's presentation, there's bits about, you know, how certain Twitter accounts or certain tweets were being blocked in Germany. They're perfectly viewable if you're outside Germany. That Twitter and some of the others have received takedown notices from certain countries.
Right.
So the takedown notice would basically say, this content is illegal in Germany or illegal in, you know, Ireland. So they won't display content to users in those countries.
Right.
But instead of just removing it, And there was a change made by Twitter where they, instead of just simply removing it, they'd actually put up something saying, you know, this tweet has been removed due to whatever, to a takedown notice. It's quite interesting. It's worth looking at. It's quite a short video. It's only about 5 minutes long. And it's an interesting study in some respects of, you know, how these companies are doing things. At the moment, the headline story on the Chilling Effects website is in relation to that article I also posted a link to. Takedown of the week: YouTube and Lionsgate Films continue to ban paradigmatic example of fair use.
Now that is extraordinary. This was a remix video done by a guy. Now he's posted this himself. He's written this whole blog post on TechDirt.com, and he's basically telling his own story. So this guy did a remix video using material from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Twilight. Is that that's my understanding of it? I wouldn't.
Yeah, no, it's too, you know. Buffy the Vampire Slayer versus Edward the Vampire.
So he's described it here as: the work is an example of fair use transformative storytelling, which serves as a visual critique of gender roles and representations in modern pop culture vampire media. Since he published in 2009, it's been viewed over 3 million times, featured and written about in various other things. Fans have translated the subtitles into 30 different languages. It's been on Slate, Wired, Vanity Fair, you name it, nominated for a 2010 Webby Award, discussed on NPR radio, and what's more, was actually used in a presentation given to the US Copyright Office at the 2012 hearings about exemptions to the DMCA. And afterwards, this particular video was cited as you say, a paradigm example, mentioned by name in the official recommendations by the US Copyright Office on exemptions to the DMCA as an example of a transformative, non-commercial video work. So this is fair use. This is the kind of thing that you ought to be able to do. And not only that, but this was picked as the prototype. This was picked as the example of exactly what it is. And then it ends up getting a takedown.
Well, I mean, it's more than just getting a takedown, Colm.
Explain what happened.
Like, he got a takedown. I mean, the entire thing is just laughable. Basically, what happened was, I mean, the story is worth reading because it's so ridiculously convoluted.
Summarize it for us, Michele.
The movie studio said, hey, that's our content. So as it's our content, we're going to monetize it on YouTube. The problem, of course, is that the ads and everything that display on these videos are quite intrusive. Mm. So he went back to YouTube going, hold on a second, you know, this is fair use, this is whatever, you know, I don't want these ads on there. And, you know, it went through an entire process. No sooner had he finished the process than the movie studio had accepted it, then they resubmitted another takedown. It's just, the entire thing is just, it's so ridiculous. So it's you know, it's a case where, you know, the fair use is being ignored completely. Mm. And, you know, the rights holders have gone, you know, they've gone a bit too far, because, I mean, they're actually taking something that even, as you say, the U.S. Copyright Office is showing as a very good example of fair use in action.
And essentially, he's describing this as a broken copyright system, that this is not working. YouTube's procedures aren't working. Lionsgate are just, who are the owners of or who are the people who are claiming the copyright infringement here, are essentially doing their, you know, ignoring the arguments made in terms of fair use and that. And he seems to have no redress here. And in fact, after the second claim, he goes on to say that he's been locked out of his YouTube account. And in fact, the video has been deleted on this occasion. He's now taking this to the next level, Michele. So this, we may hear more about this, but he has now filed what he describes as an official DMCA counter-notification with YouTube. Lionsgate has 14 days to either allow the remix back online or sue me. We will see what happens in relation to that. It's extraordinary. It's definitely I mean, when you go back talking about chilling effects, Michele, this is the chilling effect. This is exactly. I've watched a presentation. I think it was a TED talk, in fact, given several years ago by what's the man that set up Creative Commons?
No idea. Sorry.
He's a professor that specialize in this stuff. He's actually got disillusioned, I think, with trying to fight copyright and moved on, I think, to something else in recent years. But essentially, it's the stifling of creativity. It's the stifling of art, really, I suppose, and of legitimate comment and criticism. Which means that essentially this new media isn't working for us in the way that it should, and we're not seeing the benefits as a result.
No, and this is one of the things that, I mean, it's, you know, pulling this back into, you know, other realms, you know, the rights, you know, and as an if you have intellectual property rights, you need to protect them. And that's fine. You know, most people won't have a problem with that. But when there's a line between protecting your rights and extending your rights. And that's the problem. That's the problem a lot of the time here is where you're, because it's digital and because, you know, takedowns, legal actions, all these things scare the hell out of internet companies, including ourselves. I mean, don't get me wrong. Rights holders can abuse that. I mean, we were dealing yesterday evening with a bunch of DMCA requests from a company in the States. And the entire thing was just totally ridiculous. I mean, they were saying to us that we were in breach of this, that, and the other. And we're scratching our heads going, you know, what on earth have we done? And then you look at it more closely, and it's like, hold on a second. It's not us. It's one of our clients. Then you look at the website in question, and it's like, hold on a second. Our client doesn't even have the infringing content on our servers. It's somewhere else. So why on earth are we even getting this? It's just a bloody mess.
Let's cheer things up a bit, Michele. What's the gadget of the week this week? The track dot. What does it do?
Oh, my God, I want one of those.
A frequent traveller like yourself.
It's my birthday soon. If somebody wants to get me one of these, I will be so happy.
What is it?
The track dot. Brilliant concept. As you know, I didn't lose. The airline lost my bags when I went over to the States there before Christmas. And as happens, and if you talk to people who've had this happen to them, they'll give you similar stories. The airline literally did not know where the bag was. They didn't have a clue. I had handed it over to them in an airport. I arrived at another airport. My bag was nowhere to be seen. They didn't even know which bloody city it was in. Didn't even know which country it was in. The concept behind the track dot then is small little device. You shove it in your bag. It uses existing technologies. And what it will do is it can give you location information via text, SMS, or email.
Okay, hold on a second now. Suppose you are in Dublin Airport and you're flying to New York and your bag gets sent to Cairo, Michele, and you don't have, I don't know, you don't have a data plan in Cairo. How does it connect?
So all it's doing is...
How does it get online in Cairo to tell you, I'm here?
No, it's using SMS.
Yeah. Okay.
So for SMS.
So it roams onto the local network in Cairo and sends an SMS and says, I'm in Cairo.
Yes.
Ah, fair enough. Okay. So there's got to be some kind of communications thing with this as well. Have you got to pay something for it to send those SMSs or what?
Yeah, no, it's the...
You put a SIM card in it, I guess.
Okay, the pricing, the information, the website and everything is up now. I actually wrote that article, the website wasn't working. But the website is now up. The track dot luggage, which is the device itself.
You pay an annual fee for the service, is that it?
Yes.
Ah, I see.
So $49.95 to buy the device. $8.99 to activate it, and then it's a $12.99 a year service fee.
Now, if you're going on your holidays once a year at best, like I do, Michele, probably not worth it. But if you're flying around
If you're only going on holidays once a year, this is not for you.
No, but for the likes of you, this could be well worthwhile. So when are you getting it?
I want one.
When are you getting it?
As soon as the damn thing becomes available.
Right. That's the track dot, and you can read more about it on technology.ie. Michele, what are you doing this week in Black Knight? What are you giving away? What's your special offer?
Well, what we're doing is we're giving away a Kindle Paperwhite.
Oh, very nice.
I don't know. Have you seen the Kindle Paperwhites, Con?
I have. We've got, as I think I was saying to you, we've got the classic Kindles here in the house at the moment, and I'm delighted with those. The Kindle Paperwhite just has a white background. Is that the idea, or is there more to it?
The Paperwhite is like the latest and greatest version of the Kindle. I mean, you know, you've got the Kindle Fire, which has all sorts of funky features. But the Kindle Paperwhite is the most advanced e-reader produced by Amazon to date.
Okay. Well, there's the plug for Amazon. And
it's got higher resolution, higher contrast. It's got a built-in light, 8-week battery life, 62% more pixels than previous ones, 25% better contrast. Mm. Yada, yada, yada. I don't work for Amazon, so I'll shut up now.
But it's a nice gadget. And
It's a nice gadget.
It's another one of these competitions where you basically encourage people to follow you on social media, and if they complete various things, they get entered several times into the draw. Is that the idea?
That's basically it. And we're running that now until the end of the month.
Okay.
And what date's it today? Today is the 10th of January. Mm-hmm. So we'll be running that till the end of January, and then we will pick a random winner. And, the thing is, because we're using this third-party widget doodah to do it, it's completely automated in that, it's not a case of us looking at a list of entries and going, oh, we like that person, here, have a prize. It'll look after all that for us. I mean, so far there's been about 1,900 entries.
Wow, for the Kindle Paperwhite.
Now, that doesn't mean there's 1,900 people, as somebody else pointed out, in that, you get entry. It's like entry points, as it were.
Yeah. So you
for various activities.
Yeah. I'm looking. The widget is here on the blog, on the webpage here on blog.blacknight.com. And it's telling me that so far, because I've clicked on nothing yet, that I have 15 potential entries that I can enter, but I've none of those earned just yet. So I have to do things like follow you, like you, all of this, and I'll get that. Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically. So, I mean, we're running that. I mean, the reactions from it have been very, very positive. So, the thing from our perspective is if people like this kind of concept, then, we might give away something else next month. Mm. We'll see,
And it's another example of what we were talking about, really, Michele, isn't it? You're giving a little bit extra, giving an incentive, giving a reward for people who engage with you and share some of their data with you and engage with you and follow you on social media.
Oh, totally. I mean, they sign up to the newsletter, they get 5 entries or something like that. Right. They follow us on Twitter, they follow us on Facebook, Pinterest, things like that. Mm. They get extra entries and points, in return for which we're giving them the opportunity to walk away with a Paperwhite Kindle. And just so we're clear, we will ship the damn thing wherever. We're not we're not worried. So, having thought about it a bit more this evening, because I was talking to one of the Americans, if an American were to win it, we would just get an American version and have it shipped directly from Amazon.
Fair enough. Speaking of Amazon and Kindles and Paperwhites and things like that, I signed up for Amazon Prime this evening. I think I've been telling you, it's funny, since I bought the Kindle, Michele, since Santa Claus brought the Kindles, I should say, to our house, I find myself visiting Amazon more often, buying e-books, and they're getting a customer that perhaps they've never had before. I'm very much interested in especially in downloading books to read them, and it's very, very exciting indeed. So one of the things I've looked at then this evening, I've signed up for the 30-day free trial of Amazon Prime. Do you use that yourself?
I do, but the thing is this, Con, the Amazon Prime for the delivery of physical goods will only work with a UK address.
Okay, no, and I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in...
Hold on. And I blogged about this during the week, but not on the technology.ie blog, because that would be far too bloody obvious.
Yeah.
There's a service that's available. I'm not sure if it's available in your part of the country, Colm. Mm. It probably is, but we can find out. Called Parcel Motel.
Right.
Very, very simple, very nice idea. They have an address, a delivery address in Belfast you can use. So you can get the UK shipping to Belfast. They pick up, the thing gets delivered there, whatever it is, and they then put it in one of their parcel motels close to where you live.
Okay. So you could go.
So you could get something in the local parcel motel for you, wherever that is. The nearest town to you is Ennis, isn't it?
Indeed, yep.
So let's do a quick search to see if Ennis, Ireland. Well, actually, the nearest one for you would be the Cathardavon Topaz or Castle Troy.
Okay.
Well, I mean, again,
It's only down the motorway. That's all, in Limerick. That's interesting, Michele. So, fair enough. So, this is if you want to avail of what? Is it two-day delivery, is it, from Amazon?
Yeah, because I mean, the thing is, you pay... With Amazon Prime, you pay an annual subscription fee, and that gives you... And that's all you can eat in terms of deliveries.
Yeah. So, I'm not... It's not... Oh, so that covers the delivery fees, yeah?
Yes.
Oh, that is interesting. Now, as I say, I don't buy that much from them, but the reason I've tried it out this evening is that Amazon Prime users can also borrow e-books on Amazon from Amazon. So this is something I want to try out and just see if that's going to be worthwhile or not. So I'm on the 30-day free trial for that. I'll let you know how it goes.
I do, because it's. I mean, the Prime thing. I mean, it's not expensive. Mm. I mean, it's unfortunate that they don't make it available officially in Ireland. But they've broadened its scope. They announced earlier this week that they'd launched Prime in Canada, but they're not giving the Canadians access to the Amazon movies, unfortunately.
Right.
And again, you'd have the same problem. You won't be able to access the Amazon movie stuff Ireland.
Yeah, that's the thing. So it's probably limited in terms of what value it is for me. But we'll see. We'll see, as I said.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if you're able to borrow
e-books,
large enough volume of books, it'll pay for itself.
That's the thing. It's €79 if I decide to go ahead with it for the year. So we'll let you know how that goes. .cat domains, Michele, what's the story with them this week?
Well, .cat, as you know, Catalonia, it's in Europe. And one of the concerns that the guys in .cat, and hopefully we'll be able to get Nacho on the show again to talk a bit more about this, one of the concerns they've had for a long time is balancing their obligations with ICANN with respect to who it is with European and Spanish data privacy law. And you know, the baseline with ICANN contracts is if you are a GTLD registry, you have to publish who is data for all your registrants. So they've been working very hard on this the last couple of years, and eventually they managed to get ICANN to agree to allow them to treat personal non-commercial registrants, in other words, people who register domain names for purely personal use, no commercial business use whatsoever, to be able to hide their registration data. So that was finally launched a couple of days ago. And of course, as you know, Black Knight is the only Irish company that sells .cat domain names. And we are now offering that to our users. So squishy.cat is now protected by the service.
Very good. Let's move on. Next, Jersey retailer Play.com closes direct retail business. This is a report from BBC News Jersey, actually, as it turns out. What is Play.com, Michele?
Play.com, incredibly popular website in Ireland for buying CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays, games for the Xbox, the Sony PlayStation, the Wii, all these things, because their prices were very, very aggressive and they all had free shipping. Mm. And, you know, again, you know, the shipping thing is something that keeps on recurring. You know, you look at the price of something online. Oh, that's great. And then you add it to the basket, go to checkout, and it's like, oh, my God. You know, it's costing me almost as much in shipping as it is to buy the damn thing.
Okay.
Maybe it's an exaggeration, but you know what I'm getting at. It can be bloody expensive.
Yeah.
There was a loophole in the UK VAT laws up until sometime last year, which meant that if you were selling goods below a certain value, I think the value was about £15 sterling or something, you could get away without charging VAT.
Right.
So the retailers like Play.com were taking advantage of that. That tax loophole closed, and so they announced earlier this week that they were going to shut down their direct retail arm, and Play.com will become a marketplace. I suppose what that means is that it'll be a bit like eBay or the way Amazon Marketplace works, uh-huh. where they provide maybe some of the fulfillment, or maybe they provide some of the other things. They're able to provide the back end, but they're not actually selling directly themselves.
Okay, so that's a pretty serious scale back, and it's a blow really for business. And you know, it's certainly not going to employ anything like the amount of people that it did employ, or provide anything like the kind of business that it did locally in Jersey.
No, it won't, and that's kind of, I think that's one of the things that, you know, the Jersey people the Jersey government's going to be a little bit worried about. I mean, I think some of the figures I saw was it 200 staff or something like that?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a fair number of people to lose in one fell swoop.
Yeah. In fact, it's worse than that, because according to this article, they're completely pulling out of Jersey. And no, sorry, I beg your pardon. No, it's worse than that. 600 people are losing their jobs in Jersey, and 200 are going to be left in a restructured company, which will be based in Cambridge. So that is a pretty much a hammer blow. And that's exactly how it's been described in that article as well. So it's a warning in a way, Michele, that online businesses, it's not a license to print money, and it is very much vulnerable to the kind of first of all, to very stiff international competition, and secondly, needs a bit of nurturing in some cases as well. And you wonder if this VAT loophole had not been closed, if that might have saved those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad in some ways, but, you know, other sides, I mean, if you look what's been happening over the last couple of months, I mean, there's been investigations in multiple jurisdictions, right, notably in the UK, with regard to some internet companies not paying enough taxes. I mean, using loopholes, using various tricks and ways of moving their revenue around. I mean, you know, it's happened in the US. It's going to keep happening. You know, I suppose the problem, of course, is, you know, if you're wiping out that many jobs at one go, you're not going to win that many votes come election time.
Just a couple of more stories, Michele. One we'll touch very briefly on this one. We've mentioned it before. Windows, Microsoft is retiring Windows Live Messenger, or MSN Messenger, as it used to be known back in the day. It's going to officially retire in March. And just to remind people that if you're using that, you're going to be switched over to Skype instead, which Microsoft, of course, bought a few years ago.
Yeah, and there's an option with Skype to merge and migrate your contacts from MSN into Skype, which reminds me, I must get around to doing it.
Have you still got
done it?
Have you still got contacts in MSN?
Oh, of course I do. I mean, let me see. I think I'm probably logged into MSN at the moment. I think I am. Yeah.
Actually, now that I think of it, I've just seen an icon on my dock here for that. I don't know if I'm even logged in.
I'm actually looking here. I can see a bunch of contacts, and some of these are going back years. They're actually online over MSN.
Yeah.
But I don't have to use the MSN Messenger, and haven't used it in years. I mean, I used to use Pigeon on Linux, and now on the Mac I'm using Adium.
No, I can't. I can't. I'm locked out of my Windows Live Messenger. I may never get back into it, although I could get it to mail the password to me or something. Listen, Michaela, let's wrap it up. I've got one interesting story that I wanted to talk about before we finish. Did you see this one? I didn't get a chance to talk to you about it beforehand. The headline from website called DIYdrones.com. Stephen Hawking joins Foundation to defend humanity against autonomous robots. We're saved.
Thank you, Stephen.
Basically, Stephen Hawking, who is a living legend and nothing less than that, who in fact has just turned 71 this week, he's joined the board of an international think tank devoted to defending humanity from futuristic threats. It's called the Cambridge Project for Existential Risk, a newly founded organisation which researches existential threats to humanity such as extreme climate change, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, artificial life, nanotech, and other emerging technologies. You see, Michaela, we're going to destroy ourselves with all of this technology. Scientists have been predicting this for hundreds of years, or people have, I think, ever since, we're basically just going to blow ourselves up.
We don't need to worry about it because there's going to be that zombie apocalypse.
The zombie apocalypse could be in there. There you go. Biotechnology will cause the zombie apocalypse. Nanotech will turn us all into grey goo. Artificial intelligence, Skynet. Is probably one of the things people are talking about as well, you know, in relation to the singularity. You've heard about the singularity, Michaela, have you? In relation to
what's this there?
Artificial intelligence, which is basically what it means is that we are approaching, some people believe, we are approaching the day when artificial intelligence will reach the point where basically, it will be as smart as ourselves. And when that happens, apparently, or when artificial intelligence exceeds natural human intelligence, what will happen will be that the artificial intelligence will start designing new artificial intelligence, which are even smarter again. And basically,
it's
game over.
It's
at that point, it's game over, Michaela, because we'll just sit back and the machines will be in control and we can only pray that they take care of us. Please.
Oh dear. I think we better wrap this up before we hit an all-time low.
Good night and God bless. Thank you very much.
Talk to you again, Con.
Bye-bye.